despite its being the third largest of all the asteroids, Vesta is still only slightly more than 500 kilometers across. Its gravity is minuscule. Harvin and all the others working inside the tunnels and caves had to wear uncomfortable breathing masks and goggles clamped to their faces constantly because every step they took stirred up fine, powdery dust that hung in the air endlessly, floating in the infinitesimal gravity like an eternal, everlasting mist. Still, the people he passed as he glided along the tunnel all snapped salutes at the stars on his uniform. Harbin dutifully returned each salute, even though he loathed the necessity. At least his office was clean. It was a small chamber carved by plasma torches out of the metallic rock and then sprayed with thick layers of plastic to hold down the dust. With the air blowers working, Harbin could take off his goggled mask and breathe normally once the door to the tunnel outside was shut. The office was little more than a bare cubicle containing a desk and a few chairs. No decorations on the walls. Nothing to remind Harbin of his past. Even the desk drawers were mostly empty, except for the locked one that contained his medications. He slumped tiredly onto his desk chair and commanded his computer to display the day's incoming messages. "I shouldn't be sitting behind a desk," he told himself. "I should be in a ship, tracking down Fuchs. It's a mistake to let him live." Then he smiled bitterly at himself. "Not that I've been so successful at getting him. Fuchs is a wily old badger," Harbin admitted to himself. Almost, he admired the man. The list of incoming messages took form in the air above Harbin's desk. Most of them were routine, but there was one from Grigor, Harbin's direct superior in the HSS chain of command, the only man between him and Martin Humphreys himself. Harbin told the computer to display Grigor's message. Grigor's gloomy image appeared immediately. He was seated at his own desk. It was as if Harbin were looking into the man's office. To his surprise, the dour, cold-eyed chief of HSS security was actually smiling. It looked as if it pained him to stretch his thin lips that way. "I have good news for you, Doric," said Grigor almost jovially. "A dozen attack ships are on their way to you, plus supply and logistics vessels. They're not sailing together, of course. That would attract unwelcome attention from Astro, and even from the International Astronautical Authority. But they will start arriving at your base within the week. A detailed schedule of their courses, cargoes, and arrival times are attached to this message." Harbin stopped Grigor's message and checked the attachment. Impressive. Within 2 weeks, he would have a small armada of warships ready to ravage the belt. He turned Grigor back on. "From the reports you've been sending, I can see that the base will be fully operational within 3 weeks or less. Mr. Humphreys wants to make absolutely certain that the base is protected properly. He wants to take no chances that Fuchs or anyone else will attack it before it is completed. Therefore, you are to use the attack vessels as a defensive screen around Vesta. Keep them in orbit around the asteroid and keep them on high alert, prepared to intercept any unauthorized vessel. Is that clear?" The question was rhetorical, of course. Harbin wouldn't be able to get a reply to Grigor at Selene for a half hour or more. "One final order," Grigor went on, without waiting for a reply. "Once the entire battle fleet has been assembled, you will hold it in readiness until an attack plan is sent to you through me. Mr. Humphreys wants no moves made until he has approved a complete campaign plan." Then Grigor smiled again, obviously forced. "Of course, we will expect your inputs for the plan. We won't finalize it until you have made your contribution." The image winked off, and Harbin was staring at the empty chairs in front of his desk once again. "A plan of campaign," he muttered to himself. "Humphreys thinks he's a field marshal now, planning battle strategy." Harbin groaned inwardly. "He's amassing all these weapons, all these people, and he's sitting back in the safety of that underground mansion of his, playing armchair general. I'll have to follow his orders, no matter how stupid they might be." Harbin scrupulously avoided sexual liaisons with any of the people under his command. "A commander doesn't take advantage of his troops," he told himself sternly. "Besides, He had medications and virtual reality simulations that satisfied his needs, in part. In some ways, they were better than sex. He didn't have to deal with a real, living person. Better to be alone, he told himself. Better to avoid entanglements. Yet there was one slim young woman among the engineering staff who attracted him. She looked almost Asian, but not quite. Tall, willowy, soft of speech, her skin smooth and the color of burnt gold, with high, sculpted cheekbones and almond eyes that he caught several times, watching him through lowered lashes. She reminded him of someone. Someone he had taken months of rehabilitation treatments to forget. Someone who haunted the edges of his dreams. A woman that not even his drugs could erase completely from his memory. A woman who had claimed to love him. A woman who had betrayed him. A woman he had murdered, ripping the lying tongue out of her throat with his bare hands. Harbin woke nights sobbing over her. And now this Eurasian engineer watched him furtively when they were in the same room together, smiled at him seductively when he caught her staring at him. Harbin tried to ignore her, but he couldn't. Over the weeks and months of building the base, he could not avoid her. And every time he saw her, she smiled and watched him in silence, as if waiting for him to smile back at her, to speak to her, to ask her what her name was, or where she was born, or why she was here on this godforsaken outpost in the depths of nothingness. Instead of speaking to her, Harbin brought up her personnel dossier on his office computer. Her name was Lisa Jeptal, born in Cellini. Her father a French medical doctor, her mother a Japanese-American biologist. She herself was a life support engineer and had a year-to-year contract with Humphreys Space Systems. She had not volunteered for this job at Vesta. She had been faced with accepting the position or being fired for breach of contract. She's not happy here, Harbin thought, scanning her dossier. Yet she seems pleasant enough. Her supervisor rates her work highly, he saw. It wasn't until his phone buzzed that Harbin realized he'd been staring at her dossier photograph for more than 15 minutes.
Humphrey's dreams. He was a child again, being led by the hand through the majestic, marble-walled building where people stood in quiet little groups, gazing at the pictures on the walls and speaking in hushed murmurs. The paintings meant nothing to him, nor did the names that his tutor whispered to him: Da Vinci, Raphael, Degas, Renoir. Then he saw the picture of the beautiful sailboats gliding across a calm blue sea beneath the summer sun. When he refused to leave it, his tutor sniffed, Monet, quite overly popular. Suddenly it was Christmas, and instead of the painting he wanted, his father presented him with a new computer. When he started to cry with disappointment, his father loomed over him and said sternly, You can look at all the paintings you want through the web. And then he was on the boat, the trimaran, and the storm was coming up fast, and the boat was heaving wickedly in the monstrous waves, and one of the waves broke over the bow and swept him off his feet. He felt the numbing cold water clutching at him, dragging him under, while his father watched from the tossing deck, his arms folded sternly across his chest, his face set in a scowl of disappointment. He doesn't care if I drown, young Martin realized as he thrashed helplessly in the icy water. He doesn't care if I live or die. That was foolish of you, Marty, his father growled at him after a crewman had fished him out of the ocean. 9 years old, and you still don't have the brains that God gave to a rabbit. Martin Humphreys, aged 9, dripping wet and shivering with cold, understood from that moment onward that he had no one on earth to protect him, no one to help him, no one that could ever love him. Not even his mother, drunk most of the time, gave a damn about him. He was alone, except for what?